Great. Welcome to the June 1st CCG Credentials Community Group call. Today should be a fun day. We are going to step away from some of the more serious aspects of the work we're doing and hear from some of the more fun things that folks in the community have put together over the last few weeks. And so I've heard about some really interesting and creative ways to apply the work we're doing to internet culture through memes and cryptocurrency. So today we're going to hear from three guys from the community, Ori, Mike, and Wayne, about how they're really applying DIDs and VCs outside of the box. Great. So, IP note. Anyone can contribute in these calls. However, all substantive contributors to any CCG work items must be members of the CCG. It's fast and easy and free to join. And I'm going to put the link in the chat. You do need to have a W3C account, and you will need to agree to the intellectual property agreement, the contributor license agreement. All right, call notes. These minutes and an audio recording of everything said on this call are archived at the meetings URL, which I will put in. Oh, sorry. I guess I did the wrong, copied wrong thing. One moment. A note that on Friday I'm going to be holding a minutes tutorial training, and so we will go ahead and do the minutes for this particular meeting, as well as there might be some others that haven't been done. So we'll go through those as well. So we use IRC to cue speakers during the call, as well as to take minutes. And so you can make comments or cue in the Jitsi chat or in the IRC. If you want to, you do not need to type present plus anymore directly. Manu has made some updates to the CCG bot, which hopefully we'll hear from in a little bit. And now the CCG bot automatically adds it for you when you join. If you'd like to add yourself to the queue, please type Q plus, which is the plus sign, to add yourself to the queue, and you can add optional text as a reminder to what you wanted to comment. If you are not on IRC and you're a voice only, go ahead and just speak up, and we can go ahead and add you to the queue, the chairs. This meeting is held by voice, not IRC, so off-topic IRC comments are subject to deletion from the record. All right, scribe selection. I see that Manu's already started scribing. Do you want to continue scribing, or shall we find another?
Although I have to go at the half-hour mark. So if somebody could pick up the last half hour, I'd appreciate it.
Great. Is someone able to pick up the last half hour of scribing? That can volunteer now. Balaj, do you think you could try?
Sorry, hi, this is Mohamed. I can do it. If you'd like, I can do the full hour scribing, Manu, make it easier.
It's up to you. I'm happy to do the first 30 minutes, but if you're...
I'll do the whole thing. I'll do the whole thing.
Okay, awesome. Thank you, Mahmoud.
This is Balaj. Oh, wait, it was Mahmoud.
No, it's Mahmoud. It's Mahmoud.
Oh, thank you. Okay, great. Sorry, you chimed in. Great, thank you. So, okay, great. So let's go to introductions and reintroductions. Do we have any new folks on the call that would like to introduce themselves? We had a pretty small group here today. Hardcore. All right, reintroductions. Is there anyone that would like to do any reintroductions? Okay. Well, then we're just going to zip right through this. So next we have announcements and reminders. And I would like to call on Manu, if you're available, to give us an update on the recent changes and updates to the CCG bot. Manu?
Yes, happy to. Let me find a link to that email. So I sent a quick update out to the mailing list, email on updates to CCG bot. So there are a number of things we really want our infrastructure to do that it doesn't do quite yet, and so some of us are working on it behind the scenes as time permits. And so one of the things that has been, I think, you know, somewhat annoying to both attendees and people cleaning up the minutes is managing people when they join, when they leave, cleaning up the attendees list, all that kind of stuff. So now you don't have to do that because of the integration that we have between Jitsi and IRC and the scribing stuff. The second you join in Jitsi, if you have a name set, it will auto-presence you, so you don't have to do present plus anymore. So you never have to type present plus on a CCG or any CCG, you know, task force call from now on. It'll happen automatically. The other thing was updated is people were having a hard time just getting to the raw minutes. Like sometimes people wanted to be able to link to the raw audio or the raw video, you know, right after the call. When the call ends, the CCG bot will always announce where it put those files, like full URL links where it put the files in IRC. So in Jitsi, it just shuts down. You don't get to see it in Jitsi, but in IRC, there's this continuous record and it'll be put there. Other things is that, you know, if you weren't in, there's a special file called people.json. And if you weren't in that file, then you wouldn't show up. But even if you said something, you know, during the calls, the people cleaning up the minutes would have to go and put you in manually. And sometimes, you know, we forget to do that. And so you just don't end up showing up on the call. This time, anyone that joins the call is auto-present plus. They will show up even if they're not in that file. So it'll result in better lists of who was there during the call, who was in attendance, even if you don't say anything. And then the same thing for, you know, if people change their names. These are just, you know, minor annoying things behind the scenes, but we're fixing this up. And the big reason why we're trying to fix this stuff up is we're trying to make everything more and more automated so we can get to not only auto transcription. So we're hoping to, you know, use auto transcription in the future, which basically means we may not need scribes anymore. And then automated publication of minutes so that the CG bot, when you start a meeting, knows what meeting you're in. They know what, you know, the meeting title should be. They know who joined. And ideally, everyone, you know, they know who said what at what point. So if we get to that point, that's like the holy grail of, you know, meetings. You just show up, you hit the record button, and then everything else is handled for you. So yeah, that's it for the updates and why, what we're trying to head towards.
Awesome. Thanks, Manu. I just had a couple of clarifying questions, about the work. Well, first, it's really fantastic you did this work. I mean, like, you really do a lot of the heavy lifting for all this Jitsi, CCG integration. So for the links at the end of the CCG bot, like, those will come up. So you've got to already be in the IRC. And then, like, when the CCG bot closes, it'll just, like, throw up those links. Is that a correct understanding?
Yes, that's correct. And if that's not okay, we can add it to the beginning of the call. Maybe that's a better thing to do, is to also add it to the beginning of the call. The files won't be there until the end of the call. But maybe, I don't know, maybe it would help.
But anyway, basically the only people who'll be able to see that will be the folks who are already in the IRC, correct?
Yep, that's right.
So if for some reason you're not logged into the IRC, you won't see those links.
Yeah, Yeah, and honestly, like, not a lot of people need to see those links, but...
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the people, for whatever reason, the people that hang out in IRC want to see those links, so they're there now.
Yeah, I guess I'm just looking here because, you know, Ryan was specifically asking for that, and I don't know if he's one of the folks that, like, hangs out in IRC all the time, but also I think what I will do as well is I will just capture this information as tribal knowledge and... figure out a place we need to put this so it's more public on the CCG site.
Okay. Would it help, Heather, if we announced it at the beginning of the call, too? Because at the beginning of the call, the CCG bot says it tells you the IRC log that it's logging to, but it doesn't tell you the video and audio files, which don't exist. So there's like an upside and a downside. Right.
Oh, I see the log file. Mm-hmm. I mean, honestly, I think it's fine the way it is. And then I think that, you know, I'm going to be doing some training for minutes. I mean, I think it's fine. And there's enough folks that will be on a call that if someone's like, what is it? We can just have to speak to other human beings through technology. I mean, I think it's fine for now. I mean, we don't need to add more stuff to your plate to work on that. The other question I had with the PeopleJSON file is, like, how are you, like, because when you add someone to the PeopleJSON file, normally we go out and we find a link, either, like, their LinkedIn or their, like, URL. How is that working now? And I guess I'm just curious, is someone going to have to go back in to manually make some updates or changes to the PeopleJSON file at, like, some point?
Great question. I'll queue after Mike to answer.
Okay. All right, Mike, you're next.
Sure. I was just going to make a quick note, Manu, because you may not know this, but in a previous life, I actually spent several years doing some pretty extensive things related to, including building auto transcription services.
Awesome.
So when you feel that you have some basic hookup stuff, just feel free to reach out, get some time on my calendar, and I can help wire that up and we can figure out the best way to do that. Because that also, I also did that actually as part of integrations with WebEx, GoToMeeting, and a number of other web conferencing services at the time. So, I'm pretty familiar with the ins and outs and speaker identification and some of the quirkier things dealing with automated scribing. So
that is fantastic. Thank you so much, Mike. I am a total noob when it comes to that, so I need all the help I can get.
Yeah, it's a weird little dark art thing, and there's good ways of doing that and bad ways of doing it, and most of the patents are locked up by one company, but we're starting to see some competition there, so I'm happy to help any way I can on that front, and including writing code to hook into services. So
awesome. Great. Thanks so much, Mike. I will definitely reach out and ask for help when we hit that. And again, like, no ETA. This is all, like, volunteer time stuff, right? So okay. Yes. Thank you. Thank you very much for that, Mike. To answer, Heather's question, Heather, you can keep doing what you were doing with people.json. So the reason this people.json file exists is so that we can, in the minutes when somebody goes to the HTML page and they're interested in a person, when they click on the person, they go right to their LinkedIn page or their personal page, right? So it's all it is the person's homepage. That's the whole reason people.json exists. And it has become a pain. So if you're not in people.json, the default link will just take you to the CCG homepage, which is not ideal. But it automates the process if we do that. And then afterwards, Heather, so like if we're noticing like someone's showing up a lot on a call, and you click through their name and it doesn't go to their homepage, then we can just add the entry for them, right? Or if for whatever reason people call themselves something different in Jitsi from in IRC and we want to make those two aliases point to the same person, we can work with the people.json file. My expectation is that people are going to kind of forget about the people.json file after a while. I don't know how many people actually use that feature of like going to a person's homepage when you click on their name in the minutes. But that's why it's there. You don't have to feel like you need to update people.json, you know, from a week to week basis anymore. You know, all the right things should happen. So it's meant to reduce the amount of work that the people that finalize the minutes are doing and not increase it. Did that answer your question, Heather?
Yeah, definitely. Because I mean, I have, we're going to want to update the minutes, instructions, based on these changes. So I just wanted to really understand. I think what I might do is I'll do like a slight update and then just kind of watch how it works, the workflow. And maybe we'll just like update the people JSON file once a quarter or something like that. Or if it makes sense, or who knows what happens with it. But that's great. So thanks. Thanks, Manu. Anyone have other questions about the updates Manu just made to the CCG bot? Great. So the other announcements I wanted to make is that Ryan Grant had reached out to me when I had posted about the minutes, on the list, and I am going to be hosting a minutes, like tutorial. So, I mean, it's not really a tutorial. It's pretty easy on Friday. I believe it's at 10:30 Pacific. And anyone's invited, but I didn't put the link information on the list yet. Maybe I'll do it later this week. Also going to record it, and we're going to go through, creating minutes. I create minutes using the GitHub desktop or their browser interface. I don't really download any files because I don't want to just keep all those files on my computer. So it's actually really easy and fast. And if you don't have to update the PeopleJSON file, and there haven't been any changes to the CCG minutes workflow on the back end, it actually takes about like maybe 10 minutes to do it. So the goal there is to have a recording where folks can watch create the minutes. And the reason it is so easy to create the minutes now is due to the heavy lift of Kim Hamilton Duffley and Manu Sporny and other folks in the community to make it so turnkey. And it's important to have it so turnkey because we have, I think, like five other task force or work item meetings happening each week. And so we want to just make sure that it's very easy for the organizers of those meetings to record and document the minutes of all of these meetings. So that's the update on that. Okay, so the next thing is work items. And last week we talked about a couple of them, and Wayne and I closed out a couple of them this morning. I didn't really want to talk about any of them right now because most of the stuff we have is covered. We don't really have any major issues that we're tracking or we're following, which is kind of amazing. It really reflects on the chairs and having solid, consistent work. And everyone in the CCG is pretty busy. We have a lot of work happening within the work items. And so anyone who is working on the work items, if you have concerns or issues or other things that you need some help with the chairs or to address, you can always add an issue here. I'm not saying please add issues. We like having not very many. You know, things are getting done. One thing I did want to make a comment of, right now, the CCG is running on 2 of 3 chairs. So Kim, has officially completed her chair, time. And so it's, Wayne and I are running it. And so it is a bit tight, is a bit stressful to run the CCG with just 2 folks. And so, we're still open to having, you know, we'd love a third chair, and in the past, the chair time frame was 3 years, but Wayne and I have actually discussed this, and we would consider chairs that only wanted to come for 1 year or 2 years. So if you are interested, please get in touch with either of us. We have automated a lot of the work of the chairs, and we're really positioned to kick off some really interesting things, like one of the things we're waiting to get another chair to do is like Asia Pacific meetings and other things like that. So, Manu, I see you're on the queue.
Yeah, sorry, I totally forgot this at the announcements part, but since we were talking about work items, the VC HTTP API work item call is now on Tuesdays at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern, I think 10 p.m. CET. That happens, again, today, 4 p.m. Eastern. I did have a question. So, Ori, I think you're the only one that filled something out that can't make that time. I don't know if that's a temporary thing or a permanent thing. If it's a permanent thing, it could be a problem. Thoughts on that, Ori?
I think it's probably fine. We'll find out if it's a problem, and I'll follow up.
Okay, thanks.
Great, thanks, Manu. And I saw that this morning, and I have already updated the Google Calendar with that information. And if you guys need updates to any of your calendar entries, please let me know. I'm going to put a link to the CCG calendar here. And unfortunately, you do have to be a chair to make updates and changes to any of these meeting notes or the calendar entries. So just if you shoot me and Wayne an email, I'll probably be the one making the updates for that. Okay, I think that is all of the basic stuff until we get onto the main event. Okay, so I'm really excited about the presenters we have today. This topic came about during a CCG 101 call where I'm not really sure. I think we had something scheduled. Oh, we were going to do the intro. But then everyone who showed up had already attended it. So we kind of just used the time to chit chat and talk about interesting things. And so Ori and Mike showed off some of their kind of more fun, applications of DIDs and VCs. And so I thought it would be really fun to share some of this, with the community. And as I was planning it, we remembered that Wayne also did some fun stuff with Dogecoin. So we're going to hear from three guys, and I think each of you can have about 10 minutes, and then we can probably have some time for a little bit of discussion afterwards. So, Ori, do you want to kick things off with DidMeme?
Sure. So I'll start with an example. And then I will link you guys to the source code so you can fork DidMeme, make your own version of it. So, briefly, you know, what is this new DID method, DidMeme? And it's a DID method that turns, different memes into DIDs. And it does that by using what's called a covert channel, which is a channel that you can use to store information that you wouldn't normally use to store information. So it's typically used by the bad guys working on, you know, various malware, you know, evil software out there. But it can be used for fun and for good as well. Yeah, hopefully we aren't the baddies by creating it, this DID method, Mike. So, you know, what is the channel that DidMeme uses? It uses a steganography and images. So steganography, which I, good luck spelling it. I always misspell it. Poor scribe. Anyway, if you search steganography, you will find lots of great, literature on it. And it's basically a way of hiding information in images. And when you do that, you can kind of get some interesting properties. And so in this case, DidMeme is really just, hijacking DidKey. So DidKey is a way of representing, public key material, as a DID document and a DID. They kind of come together. And so DidKey is really useful, but it has some properties that are sort of annoying. Like for one, there's a unique DID key per public key. And, that's a strong correlation identifier, right? Every time you see that DID, you know, you're dealing with the same public key. So what did meme does is it just takes did key, and instead of using the public key to identify the did, it uses an image to identify the did, and it hides the did key in the image. And so what that means is, unlike did key, where the same public key always gives you the same did, did meme, you can actually have hundreds or thousands of different memes that all map to the same did. And that's useful when you're trying to avoid certain types of correlation, but you also want to use a stable identifier underneath. So, long story short, you know, didmeme uses IPFS. It has a little editor that lets you add meme text to an image and then embed the did key, public key bytes in the image. And then on the other side, when you're doing did resolution, it dereferences that IPFS content identifier, extracts the did key, public key bytes from the image, and then returns a structured did document, much like the way that did key works today. There's some other cool aspects of did key or of did meme, which all come from did key, which is you can use it with all these different key types. So in the example that we have today, it's not all of the did key methods that are supported, but one that's exciting is the BLS 12381 did key representations. So you can embed in a meme the ability to do selective disclosure zero knowledge proofs, which I find to be particularly exciting, because for a long time you needed a blockchain to do them, and now you can embed zero knowledge proof capabilities in memes. So I'll stop there, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Adrian, you're on the queue.
That's hilarious. I think not today by any means, but I would love to talk to whoever's interested, because there's a relationship between what you're just describing and what we're calling the biometric health card, where there is a QR code that can be a verifiable credential or pointer to a DID that also has a photo whose hash can be reliably included in the credential. And it sounds like did meme could be a factor, you know, could be useful in this context as well. Anyway, thank you.
Manu, you're on the queue.
Yeah, plus one, big fan of did meme. So thank you for it, Ori. I've got some couple of questions on kind of the technically what's going on. I listened carefully to what you said, but I didn't quite follow. So the identifier itself is what? It's a did key, or it's like a hash of the image?
Yeah, it's a hash of the image. So with a normal IPFS content identifier, that's a multi-hash of a binary, right? So you get a nice multi-hash representation of some binary, and it's always prefixed with a QM or a BAFI, depending on the encoding that you're talking about. So in this case, what we did was basically just use the BEC32 encoding of the multi-hash of the content of the image content itself. So it's just back there. If you convert, there's a set of conversions that you can do before you get to the cover file, which is an image. And those conversions are just BEC32 to IPFS CID to binary, right? And then once you have the binary file, inside of that binary file is embedded the did key, but it's embedded. It's not, it's embedded. Does that answer the question?
Yes. So you do inject the did key into the image before you.
Correct.
You might. Okay. Got it. Correct. And then that image goes on IPFS.
Yeah, you need, so the thing that's important here is when you modify a binary, you change its content identifier. Mm-hmm. So if you inject steganographically into a content, you change bits. Change bits, you get a different content identifier hash. So if you're going to use steganography, you should be aware that it's detectable if you have the original source image and you see that its content identifier is different for this new image. You might start to ask the question, well, why is it different? And then that can lead you down a couple of different paths. One could be that you altered the encoding of the image, which then altered bits. Another could be that someone hid some image, some information in the image, and that's what we did.
Mike, you're on the queue.
Quick note on the bit flip thing. This is one reason that using memes for this is quite interesting, because memes imply editing an image, in this case to add text, as is often the case in the strange places on the internet that many of us frequent. So you are going to be by nature altering an image, and thereby you're expecting bit flips versus the original image. And so it does help obfuscate the detection of possibly embedded cryptographic material. So.
Awesome. Wayne, you're on the queue.
Yeah, I just wanted to add into the mix the fact that memes are inherently competitive with each other, because they all take up a slice of mental energy for people to, you know, contain them and reconfigure them. So the most viral memes, you know, are the strongest competitors in this ecosystem. And I just think about how that dynamic affects the propagation of the DID method as memes are created and iterated and spread. That's it.
Thanks, Wayne. Any last comments or questions for Ori on Did Meme? Ori, thank you so much for coming and presenting this today. I know when I heard, I think you talked about one of the IIWs using steganography, and I just done a ton of research on it for my spy book, but I was just really blown away by your application of steganography to memes and DIDs. So kudos and hats off on that. I'm very curious. Some of the tech is a bit over my head personally, and I don't know that I want to go too deep into it, but I'm definitely interested in following what you guys do with this, and really curious to see the practical application of this, especially with Adrian's work. So if you guys end up doing more with this, keep me in the list apprised. So great. Thanks, Ori. Great. We're going to move on to the next one. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's fine. You can, of course, we're doing it for the lulz. Okay, Mike is up next, and Mike has embedded verifiable credential into an image to prove that the sounds coming from his conference call background is actually what he says it is. And so, Mike, you want to take it away and talk about your VC for your rooster?
Sure. So, so for context, in case you've never been on a conference call with me, I live on a small farm, and we do a lot of poultry primarily, along with a few other things like pork and odds and ends. But as a result, we get periodic rooster crowing in the background, particularly when hawks are flying overhead. And so I was on a call with a customer, and it came up that it was possible that Measure.io was using background noise and imagery artificially in order to promote our deep roots in agriculture. And so to counter that, of course, I said, well, why don't we just issue a VC for the rooster to show that? And said, that'd be great. And everyone just thought it was a joke. So, of course, I just turned around and issued a VC for that. So I'm going to pop that up. And obviously, this is also, once again, using steganography, so similar to Did Meme, but instead of embedding a DID, it's embedding a verifiable credential. I am going to share my screen, and hopefully this all comes up fine. Can you see a rooster on the screen?
Yes.
Yes. Perfect. So this is Jack. He has been with us for many years and is a great Hawk Alarm and is also fantastic at adding background noise to conference calls. So to that end, since we do things like ag products as verifiable credentials on the traceability vocab, we figured let's issue an ag product VC for Jack. And so it is issued. My wife, who owns the farm, is in there as kind of the, you know, main person with the farm for our Gallus Gallus Domesticus that we are looking at here. And here is the image hash of the raw image we just saw of the rooster. So the natural next step was to say, okay, well, now let's, you know, how would I exchange that with folks and things like that? And this gets actually at something that Adrian was mentioning, which is QR codes are very common. So in this case, we're actually looking at a QR code of the VC itself. Interestingly, with not well hidden intentionally, but with a embedded verifiable credential inside the image itself. So it's as opposed to just the QR code storing and encoding the VC, the VC itself also has digitally embedded, you know, is digitally embedded in the image of the QR code itself, so in the PNG. So that's just an interesting thing, because looking at that, when you see especially QR codes digitally represented, rather than, trying to look at stuff in the metadata of the QR code in the image, or trying to OCR it or something else, if a machine is looking at that image, you potentially want that machine to be able to go look at the digital data that's associated with it. And so that was just a little trick there. And then we, of course, took that a step further and embedded the VC, of course, in the image of Jack himself as well. So they kind of done both there. This was done with Python as the kind of underlying library to do it. I think Ori's example is in is using the steganography library for JavaScript. There's a number of them out there. Stuff we are playing with now utilizing this technique is actually for embedding in devices when certain sensor streams get captured off of hardware out in the field, to actually embed verifiable credentials of that data and the signatures of that data, even if the device is in an air-gapped environment or, you know, not well-connected all the time type environment, so that when it does get a connection, that you can go back in and verify that that sensor stream was indeed captured properly. So stuff like that. So it has some actual good real-world applications, but it's also a good way to have fun with, roosters. So with that, I will pause.
Thanks, Mike. We've got some folks on the queue. Ted, you're up.
Yeah, I just want to make sure that people understand, and this is something that it's really easy to get sloppy about, that a verifiable credential, the thing you're verifying is only that the issuer has issued this thing. So you are verifiably saying that those chickens are the source of the background noise. That's all that's verifiable. They cannot verify that those chickens are actually the source of the background noise, nor that they're near you or anything else that might be interpreted from that assertion.
Yeah, that is an excellent call out, Ted. And actually, in that case, normally with images, I strip metadata and stuff like that. I believe in this case, I actually left, the GPS, you know, the signed GPS data and some other things like that in the image. This is where, like, you know, when we talk about the veracity side of what gets stored in a verifiable credential, like, how do we actually know the physical truth of the thing we're talking about? That's where all those other pieces kind of have to come together. And even then, you're still making some leap of faith somewhere in the system. You know, even if that leap of faith is as simple as to say, yeah, this certified qPCR hardware, we trust it, right? We trust the ability of this thing to perform genetic analysis on a sample. But there is always that leap of faith somewhere in the system when we're looking at these kinds of, you know, whether you want to call it digital twins or something else, right? But this digital representation of some set of facts, you know, purported facts about a thing.
Yeah, and that purported is the vital word.
Hey, Adrian, you're on the queue.
So I put a link in the minutes in the chat to an issue that I raised that is actually quite an important use case for DIDs and possibly verifiable credentials, which I named ambient authentication, where the QR code is used to is scanned as part of the facial recognition or other kind of ambient sort of non-consented identification of people, you know, the ClearView AI model or the Clear as a business. And so the service endpoint of that DID is in effect the subject's statement of how the identification is to be used or not used. In other words, to use a DID as a way of forcing, if you want, watermarking the process of authentication when it is done without when it would otherwise be done without consent. So anybody who's interested in this, I think it's a major privacy issue, can read the thread in the link. Thank you.
Thanks, Adrian. Mike, did you want to make a comment back to that, or?
If I can get back to my mute button. Yeah, no, I think it's absolutely an important issue. And I think there's a lot of stuff when you look at streams of sensor information, right, or signals data broadly, there's a lot of stuff that digital signage applies to, right, whether or not that's done in a VC context or a DID context, I think is possibly less important. I think it's important broadly for the community, and I think that's the path forward, right, because I like that link to data side, which is why we go down that path. But I think that ability to apply veracity to know that some piece of information was captured and captured the right way, you know, off some kind of certified device, and here's everything we know about it, so that you can have a certain degree of faith in the information, is very, very critical, right? And that we're going to see more and more of that. And the importance for that ability to have some, you know, to be able to increase our trust in some of that signals information over time will be very key. So.
Great. Okay, so I'm next on the queue, and I had a follow-up question to Ted's, and I really liked his comment about your – when I think about it, it's someone is verifying some piece of data about some supply chain thing that they're issuing as a as the data. But I've also done a lot of research in IoT sensors and zero trust, and so – one of the things I was thinking about was you could actually have triangulated sensor-based data, either collecting information about your environment, Mike, like if the rooster is, like, making noise when there's, like, other birds in the sky, there could be other data that is being collected, either maybe that hawk or something has a tracking device on it, or maybe your chicken or your rooster has a sensor, or there's some kind of like sensor that is in your farm or the chicken area or even in your yard to prove that you have true free range chickens that could be used for the rest of this, you know, a credential that could pass through the rest of the supply chain that could then be combined into, say, like a digital twin of this rooster or this like egg that is coming from your farm to prove that it was not only, you know, free range or whatever, but then also it could, that data could be used to prove, that the, that noise actually came from a real rooster, not a sound effect or something like that. So it just makes my brain kind of go crazy into the whole sensor area.
Yeah, it's a really cool space. And like in our case, like, cause we deal with a lot of agriculture stuff, obviously, you know, the day job. And, you know, I mean, there's a lot of stuff where you're looking at remote sensing too, right? Drone overflight, fixed wing asset, sat imagery. Like, I don't think a lot of people realize the granularity of sat imagery, but, you can get pretty accurate, like counting animals, right, in a field at a certain point in time. But if that image has been manipulated, then you got a problem, right? So you have to know how to trust that imagery and how to trust, you know, what channels are being read from, what bandwidth of infrared and stuff like that. But it's really when you link all that data together, you can get some really interesting, yeah, we either think this thing is real or not real, and here's why, right?
Yeah, so, like, all the really interesting stuff that you might think that this work you guys are doing is just for fun, but it's really fascinating when we let our minds be a little creative that we can come up with some ways to solve things or some new solutions to some of the existing problems that we come up with that we're trying to fix, resolve here. Great. Well, Mike, thank you so much again for coming and talking to us about this. Really fun. We've got one more speaker up. It's our own Wayne Chang, and he's going to talk about Dogecoin. Wayne, over to you.
Love to share about DidDoge, the Did method for the Dogecoin blockchain. Let me get a visual aid here. I'll just pull up the spec because this is one of the few groups where you can do that and still make sense to some folks. So basically, the Dogecoin blockchain is a fork of the Bitcoin blockchain existing in an alternate reality where the segregated witness debacle did not happen. And, a lot of the signing, text is still inside the main blocks. So being able, Dogecoin is very, very similar to Bitcoin, line per line similar in most cases. If you start looking through the source code in C++, you'll see that big chunks of the Bitcoin source code are there. So it's very stable, and the maintainers seem to have adopted a similar mindset. Interestingly enough, it is with some recent surge of interest for reasons outside of the scope of this call, it is now number 7 by market cap of cryptocurrency. And what that means about the security properties is that there's a lot of money at stake if someone could break this and siphon out some of the coins before the market loses trust and collapses. So the ante has been raised in terms of the security properties of Dogecoin recently, and a lot of interest in new holders of Dogecoin. So the goal of a lot of DID methods is, depending on your use case, of course, but for the more individual control-leaning ones, where it's bring your own key, kind of like Bitcoin, DIDBTCR was one of the first ones by Chris Allen and Kim Duffy, basically, and some other folks, is being able to give people control over their identifiers the same way that you'd have control over your cryptocurrencies as an alternative to something like Gmail or AOL.com for people who still use that. And they found that if they could wed the two, the censorship resistance and the self-control of Bitcoin with these DID methods, you could achieve something similar to that. DID Doge is an iteration on their work largely. And I'll talk about the major differences and what the architecture looks like in a few minutes, within a few minutes, I should say. But basically, it's useful for two ways. One, you're getting a lot more Dogecoin holders who might be interested in having a decentralized identifier. And if they have, Dogecoin, maybe they're interested in what else they can do and what kind of digital ownership they can aspire towards. Secondly, it could be really good to inform what the evolution of DIDBTCR is, in that we have some pretty key differences from there. It's not just a copy and paste of DIDBTCR to DIDDoge. It's some iterations on it that could be useful when we're thinking about the next iteration of DIDBTCR, which I believe is a CCG work item still. And namely, the big difference is that whereas DIDBTCR requires you to base it on an existing Bitcoin transaction and posting the transaction identifier as the decentralized identifier or part of it. Doge allows you to post the public key hash or the Dogecoin address as the decentralized identifier, method-specific identifier part. And we define the DID method such that anyone can just generate a private key and go to town on it, very similar to DID key. This means that you don't need to be able to afford a Bitcoin transaction, which sometimes is $5, which is kind of difficult to use in certain parts of the world for individuals and really difficult to use for scale if you're trying to use something like hierarchical deterministic wallets that allow you to generate a bunch of different addresses at once, right? So there's some potential for privacy improvements here by allowing every single private key using the SEC P256K1 curve, which is what Dogecoin uses along with Bitcoin and Ethereum, to just create a decentralized identifier and have an implied DID document resolution if you exhaustively search the blockchain for any changes. We also support rotation of the key in a similar style to DID BTCR, and also we support adding a service endpoint. And these are very explicitly defined. So how do we know if an address is Dogecoin, it doesn't have a DID document changed on chain? How do we exhaustively search for that? Well, we introduce something called a Genesis transaction, which you post to the world to basically tell them that, hey, this is a decentralized identifier for your PKH. And I'm going to do some transformations on it, including but not rotating keys or setting a service endpoint. In this aspect, the privacy is could be potentially worse than DID BTCR, because in DID BTCR, it may be possible to hide your transactions as regular Bitcoin transactions. And there are a fair number of them, but technology is getting more sophisticated to de-anonymize them. So those are kind of the trade-offs. But for public use DIDs, like if you're a business or you're an individual and you want to share your keys, then you retain about the same privacy as using MIT's PGP key server, and that you're trying to broadcast it to everyone. And that's one of the things that the individual focus DID methods try to do. They try to create what some philosophers called common knowledge, which so you can have this kind of logical, consistent view as to what is the latest resolved key for this decentralized identifier. And we just picked a somewhat arbitrary string to declare yourself as, hey, this is going to be a decentralized identifier with these update transactions forthcoming. So this is the unique value we decided upon. Easter egg I'll show to you, my friends, but other people will have to dig through this video. But in the Bitcoin spirit, that's the hex decoding. If you're familiar with the Coinbase block in Bitcoin, hopefully you find that a little funny. But if not, then not. But basically, then we define how you do update transactions, which rotate the key, and also set a service endpoint, and then how to deactivate it as well. So this is basically the method, some privacy discussion with that. We have a Rust implementation of the major parts of it, including detecting the Genesis transaction, making sure that there's a matchup with respect to the script opcodes we expect, stuff like that. I think that, you know, with the growing user base of Dogecoin, kind of unexpectedly, there could be a re-interest in visiting this space again for the community, but it was made again to inform the future development of BTCR. Other things to consider in the next version of BTCR include the zero-knowledge proof support that was added, I believe, to Bitcoin Core, at least ratified. So that's kind of a summary of DID Doge. Welcome any questions or discussion.
Thanks, Wayne. This is so fun and so reflective of the energy and the creativity that you personally bring to the community. So any questions for anyone, from anyone, for Wayne?
Oops, I my browser kind of shut down, but I'm back.
Okay, great. Right. So let's see. We don't have anyone. Mike has asked a question in the chat. I don't know if you want to.
Why is Dogecoin the best coin? I guess if you put it with that grammar, it could be true, but I don't know.
Ha ha ha. Okay. Are you still here, Wayne, or did we lose you?
I'm here. I'm just waiting for you.
Oh, okay. I don't. There's no one in the queue. I think you've just wowed us at the end of our day. I'll give another moment if anyone's got questions or wants to make a comment for the queue. Ori, you're up.
Just, I'm not sure that I interpreted this 100% correctly, but there are a lot of DID methods out there that have a initial unregistered public key representation. So there's probably a use of the sort of equivalent ID, canonical ID for any DID that is rooted in the same SecPT56K1 public key material. So DID meme, DID key, DID doge, DID PTCR, and DID ETHR can all be represented initially from a first public key bytes. Just throwing that out there.
Completely. Heather, may I respond?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yes.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. We wanted to, working on some projects with customers at my project Spruce, we came up with something called DIDPKH that we're going to write a specification for and might propose as a work item here. PKH being public key hash, defining the different networks. Okay, so there's the super generic version of it, and there's just you state the network like BTC or ETH or something, and they have a specific mandate of how you get to the public key hash, including other mangling you do to the key material before you arrive there. But also, like, the most generic solution was kind of proposed by an engineer I work with, Charles Lehner. Basically, what if we could define some kind of stack-based maybe language to describe the PKH mangling operations unambiguously across different architectures? That's an area of interest, too. So I think I'll propose the work item pretty shortly. I hope that people will want to be involved.
Fantastic. Queue's empty. We're coming up on the top of the hour. This has been a really great, really great meeting. Thank you, Ori, Mike, and Wayne for your creativity and work. And I guess we'll conclude the meeting for today. We'll be back next week. Thank you to Mahmood for scribing. That was great for you to come on. Appreciate it.